All right, calm down, everybody. We're going to get to work. So it's been a long day. Some of us started conference committee at 9 a.m. this morning. So all right, we're just going to start over. I'm going to call it this joint hearing of the Judiciary and Public Safety and Criminal Justice Reform Committee to order. I'm co-chairing with Chair Mariani just to give folks an idea of how we're going to do this. The first part of the meeting, we're going to have Commissioner Lucero walk through the findings, similar to presentations she's been giving in the community over the last couple weeks. But we decided, we thought it was really important that we as legislators got the full walkthrough of the findings. I know folks have reached out to her as individuals, but this is the first time that we'll be lifting it up in this space. One thing I do want to note that this is still an open case. It's somewhat unusual for findings to be presented at this point in the proceedings. And so because the department is actively working on negotiating a consent decree with the city and the police department for violations of the Minnesota Human Rights Act, we're really going to be focused on listening and not so much a Q&A session. We're going to be focused on presenting the findings. So that it really limits what the commissioner is able to speak to at this point in the proceedings. So with that, you have my word that whenever things are finalized and we have a final order and final report, we will be meeting, whether, you know, obviously it's likely to be in the interim at this point, but we will be using our space to lift up that and can ask more questions at that point. But that's just procedurally where we're at in the human rights investigation and the proceedings. So, Representative Scott, did you have a question as to process?
I do. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I saw the letter out here from the city of Minneapolis. And I was really hoping that so much of the findings here talk about the failings of what the city of Minneapolis has done. I really wanted to hear from them tonight. I'm super disappointed that they're not here. In fact, I'm supposed to be at another meeting right now, and I'm really torn between staying here because many of the issues and questions that I had, and I know you just said it wasn't a Q&A period, were for the city of Minneapolis. And so I'm super frustrated that we continue to have hearings when the stakeholders aren't all here to answer questions. And it's just super frustrating. We're going to hear the presentation we're not going to be able to, you know, talk to anyone from the city to hear what their response is. And I think that's really, really an injustice for us to sit through this during the final week of session and not have that advantage of hearing
Scott,
from them.
Just so you know, we invited them. They chose not to come.
I understand that. I understand that.
I encourage you to follow up with them directly about your disappointment.
And I will, but it's super frustrating that not one city council person could be here tonight. I have a hard time believing that.
With that, the focus right now, again, I really appreciated how we ended session today. I thought it was really important that we talk about human rights and civil rights and the same listening ears that we used on the House floor at the end of session today. I hope that we'll bring to listening to these findings from the Department of Human Rights. And so with that, Commissioner Lucero, you have the floor.
Thank you, everyone. Thank you so much for the time. My name is Rebecca Lucero, and I'm the commissioner for the Minnesota Department of Human Rights. For those of you who are online, it's good to see you virtually. I'm going to just take a second to share my screen to make sure that my PowerPoint is visible to folks. So give me a second. Yep, that looks like that's up there and working. Okay, great. Okay. Now, the Minnesota Department of Human Rights is the state's civil rights enforcement agency. We are charged with upholding the civil rights of Minnesotans under the Minnesota Human Rights Act. The Minnesota Human Rights Act has been in existence for, at this point, 55 years. It was passed into law in 1967, and it's one of the strongest civil rights laws in the country. The law powerfully states, discrimination threatens the rights and privileges of the inhabitants of the state and menaces the institutions and foundations of democracy. We see that being true every day. These are the three primary duties of the Minnesota Human Rights Act. The first one has to do with investigating charges of discrimination, and that's what we're talking about today is a charge of discrimination and an investigation that we conducted. You can access the complete findings on our website. I know there were copies of those available today, and there's more information on our website as well, and that's listed here. Now, following the murder of George Floyd on May 25th, 2020, nearly 2 years ago, demands to end any discriminatory policing practices reverberated across the world. Now, MDHR heard this message loud and clear from many community members and community leaders that there needed to be an investigation into any unlawful discriminatory policing occurring in Minneapolis and whether or not that was occurring and whether it was undermining public safety. On June 1st, 2020, the Minnesota Department of Human Rights launched this comprehensive pattern or practice investigation into the city of Minneapolis to determine if the Minneapolis Police Department engages in a pattern or practice of race discrimination in violation of the Minnesota Human Rights Act. Because this is an investigation into the city and the Minneapolis Police Department, these findings only relate to the city and the Minneapolis Police Department. Now, this is a pattern or practice investigation. What does that mean? It means that this investigation is not about one individual or about one incident, but where there is a pattern within the police department of treating people of color and indigenous people differently because of their race. This means that this investigation is looking at a tremendous amount of both qualitative and quantitative data spanning from 2010 to the present, and I'll go through that in a second here. But you're not going to hear me say the name of any specific city, MPD leader, or MPD officer. This is true throughout the findings as well. And that's because, again, this is not an investigation into a specific person or incident, but about what patterns existed and where race is the likely reason and over the 10-year period of time. Now, where we flag examples or specific incidents is intended to be illustrative of the patterns that exist. So this evening I'll provide information about why what this investigation consisted of, what are the findings of this investigation, and lay out next steps, which is to negotiate a consent decree with the city. Now, I want to start out by talking about the temporary court order that the Minnesota Department of Human Rights obtained within about a week of announcing this investigation, which resulted in early and significant public safety changes in Minneapolis. Now, one clear example that you'll see here was the requirement that the city implement a policy banning all chokeholds and neck restraints without exception. Another example is that at the time the court order was entered, at least 65 completed police misconduct investigations awaited the police chief's review. At least four of those cases were over 200 days old. Now, after the temporary court order was implemented, the police chief quickly moved on this backlog. Final discipline decisions are now public on MPD's website for the first time ever. Now, as part of the temporary court order, the city and MPD were required to make these changes directly into their policies, ensuring they stay in effect even after this investigation ends. Now, what has taken other cities years to implement, we did in the first week of the investigation. And that was the first week. So now let me talk about what we've been doing in the 2 years since then in the investigation itself. Now, the team of investigators, as you can see here, conducted a comprehensive investigation that looked at the city of Minneapolis and the Minneapolis Police Department over the past 10 years. You'll see here ride-alongs and interviews that occurred with MPD officers in every precinct in person, all at the height of COVID. We owe the rank and file of the MPD a lot of gratitude for their forthcoming and honest feedback. We heard recurring themes about the need for tools, resources, and strong leadership, those themes being essential for success. You'll see here that the team of investigators watched approximately 700 hours of body-worn camera footage, observed 87 hours of academy training, and reviewed 480,000 pages of city and MPD documents, such as training materials, policies, assessments, emails, social media accounts, and discipline records. Now, I specifically want to hold space for the over 2,200 community members who we interviewed or provided reports to our agency about their experiences. as well as the 15 listening sessions, including many hosted by organizations and neighborhood associations across Minneapolis. I want to thank every community member who shared their experience with investigators throughout the investigation. Importantly, we also worked with nationally recognized policing experts to complete this investigation. We wanted to make sure we did our homework and that we got this right. Now, this included policing practicing experts at 21 CP Solutions, many of whom formerly served as police chiefs around the United States. It also included Greg Ridgway, a renowned policing statistician and professor of criminology, statistician, and data science at the University of Pennsylvania, where he is the chair of the Department of Criminology. Excuse me. And I really do want to thank everyone who supported this investigation. It was a lot of work to make sure that we got this right. Okay, so what are the findings? After completing this extensive investigation, the Minnesota Department of Human Rights finds that the city and MPD engage in a pattern or practice of race discrimination in violation of the Minnesota Human Rights Act. Now, this pattern, throughout this investigation, Minnesota Department of Human Rights determined that this pattern of race-based policing is caused primarily by an organizational culture that can be described in three ways. First, flawed training, which emphasizes a paramilitary approach to policing. Second, deficient accountability systems that are designed to not hold officers accountable for misconduct and therefore fail to hold officers accountable for misconduct. And third, former and current city and MPD leaders who have not collectively acted with the urgency, coordination, and intentionality necessary to address racial disparities in policing to improve public safety and increase community trust. I'll come back to each of these with more detail later in this presentation, but I want to move on first to discussing where we found this pattern or practice of race discrimination. So we found this pattern of race discrimination first in racial disparities and how MPD officers use force and conduct traffic stops against people of color, particularly black community members, and this is compared to white community members in similar circumstances. Next, how MPD officers use covert social media to surveil or falsely engage with black leaders, black organizations, and government officials. And this is unrelated to criminal activity. That's important, unrelated to criminal activity. And last, MPD officers' consistent use of racist, misogynistic, and other disrespectful language. So let's start by digging into this first one, racial disparities and how MPD officers use force and conduct traffic stops against people of color, particularly black community members. In the investigation, the Minnesota Department of Human Rights looked at when MPD officers use force. Now, every police department uses force, but officers should not use more severe force against black people. In fact, it is discriminatory and therefore unlawful to do so. And our findings show that in Minneapolis, MPD officers use more severe force against black people than white people in similar circumstances. We specifically looked at neck restraints and chemical irritants, and here we found that MPD officers are more likely to use neck restraints against black community members compared to white community members in similar circumstances. We also found that MPD officers are more likely to use chemical irritants against black community members compared to white community members, again, in similar circumstances. Next, we looked at traffic stops. We analyzed traffic stops because, of course, they are one of the most common ways that MPD officers and community members interact. If you were pulled over by an MPD officer from January of 2017 through 2020, then your stop is reflected in this data around traffic stops. And here we found that MPD officers are more likely to stop vehicles with people of color and indigenous individuals, and they treat black and white community members differently once they have pulled someone over. So let's start by looking at the decision to make the stop itself. MPD's data shows that MPD officers are more likely to stop a car with people of color and indigenous community members when their race is visible during daylight hours compared to when it is dark outside. And this slide, I think, does a good job illustrating this. Why is it important? Why does it matter that we look at daylight versus night hours? It matters because during daylight hours, it is more possible to see someone's race or ethnicity. So when an MPD officer has the potential to see the race of the people in the car because of daylight, they are more likely to choose to stop a car that has a person of color or indigenous community member in it. This is compared to when it is dark outside and the race of the people in the car is less visible. Now, this racial disparity in traffic stop exists across Minneapolis, and it is not the result of traffic enforcement practices in a single precinct. So none of this can be explained or excused by one precinct. Now, let's look at what happens after an MPD officer decides to stop a vehicle. Here, MPD's data shows that officers are more likely to stop Black community members for longer, search Black community members, cite Black community members, use force against Black community members, and arrest Black community members during traffic stops than white community members in similar circumstances. I do want to note that MPD's data did not contain sufficient data for a similar analysis for Latino, Asian, Indigenous, or other racial groups. However, as you can see, MPD's data did have sufficient data to analyze looking at Black community members. And again, we find that these patterns exist throughout the city, so none of this can be explained or excused by one precinct. And I want to take a moment here to talk about the methodology behind this analysis. Now, how did we determine that race is the likely reason for this difference? So since Black individuals comprise approximately 19% of the Minneapolis population, you might think that anything over 19% of all searches conducted by MPD officers of Black individuals would be disproportionate. And that's what this data shows right here. So from January 1, 2017 to May 24, 2020, MPD's data shows that 78% of all searches conducted by MPD officers were searches of Black individuals or their vehicles in MPD's five precincts. Now, there is substantial disproportionality of searches here. But despite the substantial disproportionality of searches, you might hear city or MPD leaders as well as MPD officers state that this disproportionality is due to factors other than race. So as an example, someone might explain that MPD officers patrol parts of the city that have more crime. So geography is the primary reason for the disparity. So to consider this and to look at this, we did additional analysis that looked at what happens when MPD officers interact with Black community members and when MPD officers interact with white community members in similar circumstances, to see if they are treated the same or different in those similar circumstances. So really an apples-to-apples analysis instead of, or as well as, a proportionality analysis. And this is what you see here. This is this way, when we do that apples-to-apples analysis, we analyze searches during traffic stops. We control for those factors, like geographic location, for factors such as the year, the month, the day, and time of day. So these can't be the explanations or the excuses for race disparities. This means that where there is a difference, race is the likely reason for this difference. Next, let's talk about MPD officers' use of covert social media to surveil Black leaders and Black organizations unrelated to criminal activity. Now, law enforcement agencies may have legitimate reasons to track social media activity, and police departments may specifically have a reason to use covert social media if a clear investigative purpose exists to advance public safety. However, a review of MPD's covert social media accounts from at least January 2010 through December 2020 demonstrates that MPD officers used covert or fake social media accounts to surveil and engage Black individuals, Black organizations, and elected officials unrelated to criminal activity without a public safety objective. Unrelated to criminal activity. Okay, so what is a covert account? Now, it's an account where an MPD officer is using a social media account and they are using a fake name, a fake picture, and are presenting as someone that is different who they really are, not as an MPD officer. And they're using MPD's own covert social media accounts. And here, our focus was on MPD officers using MPD covert social media accounts unrelated to criminal activity. So let's talk about that. MPD officers use MPD's covert social media accounts to conduct surveillance unrelated to criminal activity and to falsely engage with Black individuals, Black leaders, and Black organizations. In one post, an MPD officer used a covert account to pose as a Black community member to send a message to a local branch of the NAACP criticizing the group. MPD officers also used MPD's covert accounts to send private messages criticizing elected officials. They did this while posing as community members, using MPD's covert accounts. Now, police officers using covert social media to contact and criticize elected officials can undermine the democratic process because false communications can distort elected officials' perspective of positions taken by community members. Police officers can use covert social media for a clear investigative purpose to advance public safety. And police departments that use covert social media must have clear procedures and accountability mechanisms in place to ensure that covert social media uses have a close nexus to a true public safety objective, and it is not being used for a discriminatory manner. Let's next talk about MPD officers engaging in a pattern of race discrimination through racist, misogynistic, and disrespectful language. Now, according to body-worn camera footage, discipline records, statements from community members, and interviews with MPD officers and prosecutors, some MPD officers and supervisors use racist, misogynistic, disrespectful, and offensive language. And they use this language to everyone, to criminal suspects, witnesses, bystanders, and to fellow MPD and city employees. We're next going to return to the slides about how this pattern of race discrimination is caused by organizational culture, that it is created and demonstrated through consistent behavior. Now, MPD maintains an organizational culture where officers consistently use racist, misogynistic, and otherwise disrespectful language. Furthermore, MPD does not uniformly and consistently hold officers accountable for using this language, which reinforces this kind of organizational culture. This consistent behavior manifests and reinforces this culture. So let's go back to looking at this slide again, and specifically talk about the organizational culture, starting with trainings. Now, MPD's data shows that MPD officers are using unnecessary and excessive force, that they are escalating situations instead of de-escalating situations, and that there is race-based policing occurring. So it is not surprising that trainings are infused with a paramilitary approach and that the warrior mindset given this data. Now, although the city formally banned official warrior-style training in 2019, much of MPD's current trainings continue to embed this warrior mindset into its officers. On the very first day of academy training in 2021, police recruits were told instant and unquestioned compliance is an order. Now, this mentality of unquestioned obedience is endemic within MPD's organizational culture and undermines MPD's written policies. For example, if the written policy is that an officer has a duty to intervene where there is unlawful use of force occurring, and the actual policy of instant unquestionable compliance exists, that undermines the existence of that written duty to intervene policy, rendering that written policy useless. Now, this instant and unquestioned compliance is also the same tone, then, that many MPD officers set with community members. And this sets up a real us versus them dynamic with community members that are sworn to serve and protect. Now, MPD also fails to provide comprehensive cultural competency training for officers. In fact, when MPD shortened its 2021 academy training sessions, MPD eliminated conversations about practicing cultural competency when working with specific community groups of color and indigenous community members. Now, in a city with such racial and ethnic diversity, the choice to eliminate these trainings is concerning. Now, these changes happened after the investigation was launched. And the decision to do so at that time is further concerning. Now, trainings are important because they are where the culture of MPD is taught, how culture norms are reinforced, and what happens when officers violate these culture norms. Here, the Minnesota Department of Human Rights found that MPD's trainings reinforce a culture that exacerbates a pattern of race-based policing. Next, let's talk about the flawed accountability systems and the pattern and how and how that feeds into the organizational culture. Okay, so let me start by talking about how supervisors tacitly or directly approve inappropriate and potentially unlawful behavior. So let me do this by giving you an example that is illustrative of the pattern of supervisors approving inappropriate and potentially unlawful behavior. So in this example, an MPD officer came into a bedroom to find an unarmed black 14-year-old sitting on the floor using his phone. The MPD officer demanded that the kid stand up, but the kid didn't do so fast enough for the officer. Now, all of this was happening very quickly. The MPD officer took out his flashlight and hit the 14-year-old kid across his head with the flashlight, causing the kid to bleed. Next, the officer grabbed the kid by the neck and did what's called an unconscious neck restraint, which, as the name suggests, means the MPD officer choked the kid until he was unconscious. Now, following this incident, and I want to be clear, the kid is okay. Following this incident, the supervisor reviewed the file and approved this use of force and said there is no violation of policy or law. So by deeming this officer's use of force appropriate, the supervisor effectively authorized the officer to continue using such egregious force in the future. Then, if an investigation were to occur, and in the example I just highlighted, no investigation occurred, but if one were to occur, investigators regularly fail to properly investigate a significant percentage of police misconduct cases. This includes especially misconduct cases where there may be problems with race discrimination. Next, MPD fails to consistently hold officers accountable. For instance, if an investigation does occur, oftentimes officers are supposed to receive coaching. But the investigation found that 37% of the time officers were supposed to receive coaching, the supervisor simply did not coach the officers. That means the officers did not get that support, resources and training that they clearly needed to be successful. This means that in those moments when supervisors are failing to provide this coaching, the supervisors are setting the officers up for failure. And finally, when discipline decisions go to arbitration, and it is rare, it's about 20 times in the last 10 years for discipline, they are often reduced due to preventable factors within the city and MPD's control. One arbitration case particularly demonstrates how factors within the city and MPD's control impact arbitration outcomes. So in a case from 2019, an arbitrator reduced a termination decision to an 80-hour suspension. Now, in this situation, an officer had potentially used excessive force when making an arrest. Now, the city and MPD did the right thing and relieved the officer of duty, requiring the officer to stay home before eventually assigning the officer to a desk position with no contact with the public while an investigation occurred. Now, the investigation resulted in a recommended finding that the officer had, in fact, used excessive force. However, the day after that finding was issued, an MPD leader decided to send the officer back to regular duty with full enforcement responsibilities, then further relied on that officer as a field training officer to train other officers. Next, it took over a year for the city and MPD to ultimately terminate that officer from that incident. Now, the arbitrator overturned the decision to terminate, and it did so in large part because of the decision of MPD to return the MPD officer to regular duty, including field training. Now, after a recommended finding of excessive force had come out, and that it then took an additional year for the city and MPD to terminate the officer. This example highlights the factors that are fully within the control of the city and MPD. Importantly, community members of color and indigenous individuals especially experience the ramifications of the failure of these accountability systems to address race-based policing. Now, another way we can understand culture is by looking at leadership and seeing what they say and what they do. Now, as a result of a lack of coordinated and sustained action to address racial disparities in policing, city and MPD leaders throughout at least the past decade have allowed MPD to maintain an organizational culture that demands unquestioned compliance, emboldens aggressive escalation, and is averse to accountability. Now, leadership is critical. Leadership is critical to bring about organizational culture change and address race-based policing. Now, throughout our investigation, former and current city and MPD leaders acknowledged that there is a problem with MPD's organizational culture that results in racial disparities. And over the 10 years that our investigation looked at, there were certainly instances where city and MPD leaders acted. For instance, Minneapolis banned warrior-style training for police officers. Yet in some cases where city and MPD leaders attempted to implement changes, current and former city and MPD leaders failed to collectively act with that necessary coordination and sustained action that's required to make the changes for organizational culture that welcome accountability and oversight. Also, in some cases where city and MPD leaders attempted to make change, those attempts were eroded by city and MPD leaders providing inaccurate or misleading information to the public. And when city and MPD leaders provide inaccurate information, it sows community distrust, it creates confusion, and it undermines meaningful attempts of change. So leadership is critical. And our investigation identified that there has been a vacuum of collective action from key city and MPD leaders, and the organizational culture at MPD has existed unchecked, resulting in unlawful discriminatory policing that undermines public safety for at least the past decade. Now, this brings me to this last slide here, which you'll see lastly on page 8 of the determination, where we talk about that the investigation finds that without fundamental organizational culture change, reforming MPD's policies, procedures, and trainings will be meaningless. Now, this is a big statement. It speaks to the scope of the challenge that lies ahead. So let's talk about what's next and what we've been working on since these findings were announced. Because this process does not start or end with these findings. As I mentioned, the city has made and continues to make efforts to address these concerns. And as we note throughout the determination, the city can make immediate changes that are fully within the control of the city and MPD and do not require modifications to the collective bargaining agreement or state law. So the Minnesota Department of Human Rights is working with the city to develop a consent decree to address this discriminatory, unlawful race-based policing in Minneapolis in violation of the Minnesota Human Rights Act. So let's talk about what a consent decree is. Unlike previous efforts to reform policing in Minneapolis, all of which matter, they all count. The consent decree is different because it is a legally binding agreement that the parties are required by law to follow. And this is a tool that has never been used in Minneapolis before. A consent decree lays out specific changes that the city and MPD are required to make to address the pattern of race discrimination in violation of the Minnesota Human Rights Act. Because a consent decree is issued by a judge, it is the judge that holds parties accountable with monitors that report the progress directly to the court. Now, a consent decree also lives on past all election cycles, which provides for that sustained action that I talked about as really necessary for success, and it's not subject to the whims and pressures of elected officials. Well, this is a tool. A tool can be very powerful, but it is only a tool, which is why we want to make sure that we're being just as thoughtful in this next phase to get this right. To that end, the Minnesota Department of Human Rights is working directly to hear from as many folks in Minneapolis as possible. So we have multiple streams of engagement. First off, we will be hosting listening sessions with rank-and-file police officers at each precinct, and we're working with, again, policing experts, 21CP. Anyone at this time can submit their thoughts and ideas directly to MDHR on the website. People are doing that every day right now. We'll have larger engagement events or sessions. Those opportunities will be throughout June, early July. And then, of course, engagement will be built into the consent decree itself for monitors, and what that looks like, we'll be working with community members and the city to develop moving forward. Now, I started this presentation by talking about how following the murder of George Floyd, demands to end discriminatory policing practices reverberated across the world. Now, those demands remain just as urgent today with this announcement of the, when we announced this investigation, and these findings, which paints an unsettling picture of the city of Minneapolis and the Minneapolis Police Department engaging in a pattern of racial discrimination over the last decade. Now, race-based policing is unlawful. It harms everyone. It especially harms people of color and Indigenous community members, sometimes costing community members their lives. Now, I look forward to the continued work on this, and I thank you very much for this opportunity.
Thank you, Commissioner. I know I printed and read through the report and read articles about the report, but I do think this format is helpful in highlighting, and I think especially highlighting some of the systemic issues and not sort of the horrifying individual examples that were shared to highlight those. So thank you, Commissioner. As I said, members, we'll have the department back when things are finalized, and we will go from there. And we have, thank you, Commissioner. And with that, we have quite a few folks signed up to testify to share community feedback on these findings. And with that, not very hard to pass the gavel, Mr. Chair. Over to Chair Mariani for the next part of the hearing.
Very well. Thank you, Chair Beckerman, and thank you to our Commissioner of Department of Human Rights. Very vitally important, difficult, complex, but very vitally important work. And I think it's equally important that we have good discussions at the legislature as we are called upon to make meaning to tragic and difficult events that have impacted so many Minnesotans for so long, and particularly those Minnesotans from our people of color and indigenous communities, and as this report points to, in particular, our African-American Minnesotans. Before I call out testifiers, I just want to quickly say that, and sort of set the stage for, you know, why we are opening ourselves up to have the sharing from community members. Seems to me that the wisdom of our state is that we build systems. We build systems and we build laws that are focused on many things, including preventing the harm of all residents in our states from in our state from all sectors. And to do that, we have a complex architecture, if you will, of systems that exist in our state departments, boards, and agencies, and that are replicated at our local level. We do this, as I said, you know, to make sure that there is protection, prevention from harm being caused by anyone to anyone in our state, and then we also have an appropriate way to respond when harm is done, because criminal acts do occur, and so we want to make sure we have robust, smart public safety, corrections, judiciary systems. And part of that system is our Department of Human Rights. This investigation begs policymakers like us, especially us as legislators, I believe, to look at how state-level public safety agencies can best contribute, guide, prepare, and report on public safety policies and practices to be free from racial discrimination and harm. It also begs how and whether the state ensures that those within our public safety systems who engage in harm, including race-based harm, are held to account for violations of human rights that are guaranteed in our state constitution. We all swear an allegiance to the constitution every 2 years. I'll miss doing that, Representative O'Neill, next year. I've done that 16 years, and we all take that quite seriously, absolutely. This evening, We wish to hear from citizens, particularly those who are or can speak for those who have been harmed, what they think. What they think. These investigations, the findings of these investigations should have on our actions as legislators, as we provide oversight for our public safety systems of delivery and accountability. And so in the best and true good spirit, it's important that we listen. It's what we do in these committee hearings for days on end to citizens and be informed and guided by their expectations, and that we struggle with how we constantly adjust our laws and adjust our expectations of our public safety systems in Minnesota. And so that's the purpose of this part, is to, within the context of the investigations findings that we heard from today, to invite citizens to reflect on what they think that means for our actions as legislators as we provide oversight to those very public safety systems. And so I do want to hold, there is a list of testifiers who have signed up to be with us here today. I'll get to this in a second. And so I want to make sure that we hear from everyone, and then we'll have a hopefully a good opportunity to have a conversation with them, asking questions, and then with one another as well. So with that, I think my first, who's up there a second ago?
Mr. Chair, really quick. We didn't do roll call, and I know this is a really important meeting. I'm just wondering if you could break just for a moment just to do roll call to acknowledge those that are actually present here and virtually.
Yeah, you know, the chair and I talked about, because you're right, it is here and we should have roll call, and so there's two ways we do it. People can either name verbally, or we can have our staff record everyone. But you're requesting a verbal.
Mr. Chair, it's number one on the agenda, and I know this is a really important meeting, and I'm sure that those that have taken the time to be here would be.
Yeah, no, I think it's appropriate. So, I mean, we do have a recorded roll call. We do have our staff recording everyone, but you're asking for it. Oral.
Mr. Chair, that's just normally we just do an oral, just because it's hard to know who's here and who's not for those that are in the room, like who's virtually.
Well, let's try to do that as quickly as possible.
And right? For the public.
Oh, that's fine.
It'll
absolutely
be in a minute.
Yeah.
But they don't see
it.
No, you don't push it. It's already.
Oh, sorry. Thank you.
Senate.
Chair Mariani.
Present.
Chair Begerfin.
Present.
Vice Chair Frazier.
Present.
Vice Chair Mueller.
Present.
Lee Johnson.
Present.
Scott.
She was present, she had to leave for another meeting.
Oh, perfect. Thank you.
She was actually already
gone. Edelson.
Present.
Feist.
Present.
Russell.
Present.
Kerr. Hollins.
Present.
Hewitt.
Present.
Cleborn.
Present.
Liebling.
Present.
Long.
Present.
Lucero.
Present.
Mortensen. Mueller.
Present.
Novotny.
Present.
O'Neill.
Present.
Farr.
Present.
Pinto.
Present.
Poston. Raleigh.
Present.
Robbins.
Present.
Bang.
Present.
Zhang.
Present.
Jean T. Sorry.
Present.
Chair Mariani.
Is that it for roll call?
Very
well, thank you.
Poston should be excused.
Poston, excused. If let's note that. All right. Why don't we begin with our testifiers, Representative Johnson. I really want to spend our time listening first to citizens, and then I'll open this up for comments and conversations and discussions
Chair Mariani, it's disappointing. We had members on our side of the aisle had questions for Commissioner Lucero, and she left. As soon as she got done testifying, I want the people to know that she left this building, left this room, and unable to answer any questions. So it's really disappointing.
Was well explained, Representative Johnson. It was very clear the reason for that. I also understand that you have met with her on your own to ask questions. I know she is willing to do that for folks, but as we explained, there's not a bill before us. We're not voting on anything. This is a special thing that we went out of the way to do to lift up these findings, but the same as in any other judicial-type process, we've got to follow the rules and make sure that we are not upsetting that process. And so she was more than clear that was the expectation, and we'll have her back, and you can ask many questions when everything is finalized.
Representative Decker-Finn, that is true. This is an ongoing investigation, and this is a public hearing by the legislature. Just by having her here and giving that information and having the public testify, it could damage that investigation and cause some issues. So I am hoping that the testifiers that we do have are truthful and honest and give proper information, unlike some testifiers we've had in the past that have given false information. As the report came out on an issue during the last week, where the testifier
Representative Johnson, we're here to talk about the Minnesota Department of Human Rights findings and to hear from community members' thoughts on that. You and I can certainly talk about any other issues in other committees, but you know, it's a poor way to start this hearing by suggesting that we've got people in the room here. We're not going to be honest. And so, Representative Johnson, why don't we just sort of cool our jets for a second, listen to the citizens,
and then
you and I can do some debating. If you want to do that on the record, we can do that. But let's stick to the agenda for now. That's really the fair thing for us to do with citizens in the room. And so with that, members, we're going to start with Mr. William C. Jordan, Jr., president of the Minnesota Dakotas chapter of the NAACP. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Jordan. If you can begin by stating your name for the record and then giving us your testimony, advice, and thoughts, we would greatly appreciate that. Welcome.
Thank you. Good evening.
Good evening.
My name is W.C. Jordan, and I'm the president of the Minnesota Dakotas Area State Conference of the NAACP. On behalf of the NAACP State Conference, I would like to thank Jamel Lundy, Committee Administrator for the Public Safety and Criminal Justice Reform Committee of the Minnesota House of Representatives, and the Judiciary and Public Safety and Criminal Justice Reform Committees for holding these hearings. The report by the Minnesota Department of Human Rights details a runaway, racist, unaccountable, and out-of-control police department. The report is shocking, but sadly familiar. All of us have known, or should have known, what has been happening. The department's report is only one more in a very long list to tell us about widespread systemic racism in our law enforcement. The hearing is important to answer two critical questions. How could this happen in our state? And how can we prevent it from happening again? Or stop similar behavior that might be happening right now? I don't have much time, so I will leave the first question to all of you to answer. As to the second question, accountability measures need to be greatly enhanced to empower private actors and improve the state oversight system. Private accountability measures could include, one, empowering victims of police abuse by enacting a state-based section 1983 law, like Colorado did in 2020, that eliminates qualified immunity. Require officers to carry personal liability insurance to leverage the power of insurance companies to root out bad cops by refusing to insure them. 3, mandate better data collection by each department, such as racial demographics for investigative stops, and make the data more readily available so media and community organizations can help track racist patterns and practices in other departments. The state oversight system can improve too, such as 1, continue to enhance the power and oversight function of the Post Board. We have made progress in the last 2 years on this, but the state oversight mechanism is clearly not yet sufficient to prevent what took place in Minneapolis. Fund similar, if smaller, reviews of other departments. Racist policing is not limited to Minneapolis. We should not have to wait for the next George Floyd to examine what is happening in departments across the state. This is an abbreviated list, of course, given the short time I have to provide testimony. However, on June 13, 2020, we testified and presented a written statement with dozens of other reform recommendations on use of force standards, data collection, accountability measures, and specific structural reform to the state's oversight system. We have provided the committee with the aforementioned testimony and would like it included in the record of today's proceedings. I strongly encourage you to revisit those recommendations and the many other recommendations made by others about reforms that would prevent and address the sort of conduct outlined in the department's report. In closing, I want to thank the Department of Human Rights for its hard work on this important report and these committees for holding these hearings. I offer the services and partnership of the NAACP's State Conference to both the department and these committees in making certain this report does not end up like so many past reports have, without significant action and follow-up. Let this disturbing report be the wake-up call we so badly need in our state to finally do all that is necessary to prevent this from ever happening again. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Joyner. I appreciate you being with us this evening. Hopefully you can be available a little bit later when we open this up for questions and further comments. Next we have Michelle Gross, President of Communities United Against Police Brutality. And she's here physically in the room, so we'll give her some time to move up to the testifiers table. Ms. Gross, are you going to be starting us off here? I'm glad that all the testifiers are up there. That kind of saves us a little bit of time. So.
That's what we thought, too.
Yeah,
so
well,
thank you.
Well done, well done. It's
thank
good
you.
To see you. It's been a while since, you know, because of COVID. It's been a while since I've had you in the testifiers table before us, but welcome.
Thank you. Good evening, Chair Beckerfin and Chair Mariani and members. My name is Michelle Gross, and I am the president of the organization Communities United Against Police Brutality. We were asked, and by the way, thank you to Mr. Lundy for requesting us to testify. We were asked to put together a testimony of from our coalition, and so what we're going to ask is for Courtney Ross, who has joined us this evening. I'm going to ask her to testify first, and then Mr. Jelani Hussein, and then myself. I'll finish up. So.
Very well. So it looks like you're starting us off, and if you can do that by just stating your name for the record, I'd appreciate it.
Absolutely. Good evening. My name is Courtney Ross. As a former educator, I look out into the crowd and I can see people are tired and they're distracted. And I'm going to revert to a phrase that I use with kindergartners. One, two, three, all eyes on me. I'm here to speak and I would appreciate being listened to. I am not a city council person, not a commissioner of anything. I am George Floyd's fiance. I sit here before you as a representative of hundreds of families who have lost loved ones to police violence in our state. I also sit here before you as a white woman who has experienced privilege my entire life because of my skin color. A privilege that the love of my life, Floyd, never knew. In fact, as the report from the Human Rights Department showed, Floyd was murdered because of his black skin. As my dear friend and founder of Family Supporting Families Against Police Violence often says, George Floyd is the face of hundreds of black men murdered in the state of Minnesota in the past few decades, including St. Paul, Brooklyn Center, where my student, former student Dante Wright was murdered by the police, and also Falcon Heights. And like Floyd is the face of hundreds of black men murdered by the police, the Minneapolis Police Department is a reflection of all the other police departments across the state of Minnesota and the United States. Police departments that act out of racial bias and discrimination and have been allowed to hurt our communities for years. Again, I'm going to say, I might not be the person you want to hear, but I do expect to be listened to, anyone who's distracted by their phone. Now that we have the data, now that we know that Minneapolis Police Department officers were performing their job duties with clear racial bias, the laws need to change. It is imperative to act now before any more lives are taken from us. We need acts that have been presented to all of you, such as the Justin Tigan Act, to become law. That act would be in order to reopen cases for our families that lost loved ones by the hands of racist police officers. The evidence is clear, and it is time to hold police departments across the state accountable. Excuse me. I ask of you, all you legislators here today, not to be listening as the role that you have to play, but as humans with hearts. Please go home tonight. Remember the changes that you can make in this state. I am a proud member of this state, but my faith is being tested. I will end with asking all of you to please, when the consent decree is being formed, please make sure that families that have lost loved ones to police violence get included. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Ross. You and I have not met, and it is a privilege to meet you, and please know my deep sorrow for the murder of your loved one.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Mr. Jelani Khan.
Thank you, and thank you, Courtney. My name is Jelani Hussain. I want to start us off by also greeting you all in this room and those who are not in this room, greeting of peace. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. May peace and blessings be upon you all. I am the executive director for the Council of American Islamic Relations, Minnesota chapter here. I came to this country in 1993 and lived in Minneapolis for one reason. I came here for peace and safety. And I'm a firm believer that every single one of you sitting here and those who you represent wake up every morning to live in a community that is peaceful, sending out our children in a peaceful community. All of this under the protection that we are all respected and valued as human beings first. I also believe, I'm a firm believer, that good policing, good health care, good any industry welcomes any form of accountability, transparency, and efforts to serve those that whom entrusted with to serve better. For many of us, people of color, particularly black people in this country, and particularly here in Minnesota, this report is a validation of the lived experience that we all have. To many of you and to many that will listen to this, especially our community that is predominantly white, may not have experienced this and may not understand this. But the violation that the Minnesota Department of Human Rights found is a violation of the dignity of human beings. And we are in a difficult moment, and I'm a firm believer that God chose us in this moment because there's something good in this state, and there's some good in people who are sitting in front of us today. We did not choose this burden to carry the legacy of the most recognized police brutality case in the world. It did not happen by a vacuum to happen in the middle of a pandemic when we all were in our homes and had to watch that video, but we did. And history will always teach us that people will continue to deny justice, to act as if they have not seen it. But I believe this is a moment for our state to lead not only our nation, but the world. We profess to the rest of the world that not only this is a beacon of hope and democracy, but we also self-govern. And in the darkest chapters of our nation, we have fought to make inclusion even possible to what it is today. And that's why I'm hopeful that in this state, in this moment, we do not turn away from this problem. But we Minnesotans come together and realize that we can help each other. And we can help this industry of law enforcement truly serve all of its populations in a manner that is dignifying, humifying, and I believe that is the call in front of us. Yeah. No, I'm not done. I'm just getting started. I want to just point out, as the commissioner pointed out very clearly in this report, and there's a lot to unpack, so I will focus on the part that I feel most important to reflect. This report identifies racial disparities, particularly how people of color and black people are dealt with, whether it's a use of force or traffic stops. It also talks about some of the challenges that those who call out the system are facing, intimidation, tactics to undermine, and any good work will face that. And we believe that is part and parcel of what's been happening. Racism, misogyny, disrespectful language, this is something that we do not accept in our own homes. Neither should we expect from those who we hold to uphold the law in our communities. The most troubling aspect of this report, it outlines everything that you've heard of. Black people are more likely to be stopped. Black people are more likely to be searched. Black people are more likely to face use of force, and black people are more likely to be arrested, incarcerated. This is not new. but now we can't turn away from it. The part that I wanted to specifically discuss, which is incredibly important because I believe this body and the legislature, especially the state leaders, have a responsibility to respond to accountability. The commissioner mentioned this. If a police officer makes a mistake, they're human beings, they can make mistakes. There's a checks and balances. The next officer, the sergeant, the person in charge of dealing with that incident, is not holding them accountable. When the superiors, then that incident reaches that level, they're also not holding them accountable. And furthermore, there is no level of accountability that this report shows to be a hope or something that is actually in existence. In fact, the Minneapolis Office of Police Conduct Review, in its 8-year history, and these numbers are right at the time when George Floyd was killed, we know that citizens do not report against the police. But for those who did, 3,434 incidents, only 20 police officers were held to somewhat of an accountability. That is 0.58%. The national average is 7 to 8%. If you're wondering why and how important accountability is, if we do not ingrain it into the law, if we do not provide opportunities for communities to find reprieve, if we do not create systems that hold police officers to the same standards that every single citizen in the state is held to, we are not creating a system of justice, we are creating a system of injustice. Derek Chauvin had 26 citizen complaints out of that 4,000 that I just mentioned. He was involved in 6 deadly force incidents. He was involved in killing 5 people. And he had dozens of choking incidents, including the 2 that were tried in federal case. When we talk about accountability, we do not have it in the largest public safety department in the state of Minnesota. And this report shows that if a police officer today, as we are speaking in this room, violates the human rights of a human being in Minneapolis, there is no accountability. And if they report it to the civilian office review, there will not be accountability. It is easy to ignore the voices of many people who have said every single thing that this report says, testified before you. You've heard it in the news. It's time to start believing in the impacted communities. And it's time for leaders of both parties to recognize that we have a moral and ethical responsibility to hold law enforcement accountable, in order to ensure that we can fully say that our justice system is true to its core. And right now we cannot say that. We are all children of God. God is the one who has given us the value, and he's the one who's dignified every single human being. If we have politicized this, we would have politicized the most sacred aspect, which is the human value. So I hope this hearing does not become another political charade, but it becomes what it is, an opportunity to lean in and fight for a better Minnesota and a better United States of America. We have done it before in the past, and we can do it once again. And there's no one else coming to save us. We have to save ourselves. And if I speak to the young people in the community who do not believe that police officers not only respect them, but that they are the law, that the vanguards protect us, we cannot have a conversation with them about moving forward if the Department of Human Rights says that the city of Minneapolis is in violations of human rights. So I implore to you and to the many people who will eventually hear about this report and continue to hear this work, I am disappointed that we did not have the outcry that we have in other industries. If any other report came out about our vaccines or healthcare or anything else, there'd be nights and nights of discussions about what to do. But when it's about Black people in this state, we seem to find fallacies to hide behind. Well, I personally believe in God, and I do not believe any of you are sitting in those seats by accident. And I do not believe that there will be a day that you will stand in front of God and say you could not have seen the humanity in others. Good policing, good law enforcement welcomes accountability. It is your job now to advocate for good policing and good accountability in our state. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hussain. Thank you. Ms. Gross.
Again, good evening, Chairs Beckerfin and Mariani and members. My name again is Michelle Gross, and I am the president of Communities United Against Police Brutality. We are in our 22nd year of working for professional, accountable, and constitutional policing. I personally have been involved in the efforts for police accountability and professional policing for 34 years. When this report came out, people like me felt vindicated. These are the very things I have been talking about in this city of Minneapolis for 30 years. And this city could have been listening to the members of the community, not just me. I don't think I'm a renegade or by myself. There are many people in the community who have raised these issues over and over again. And the city could have and should have listened to us all along. Had they done so, we would not find ourselves in the position in which we are at this point. Basically, the city is in a position where, you know, we've got this report. It's damning. It's horrific. But it begs for solutions. And so I'm eager to talk about solutions, which I will in just a second. But before I do, I want to mention something. The next step is going to be a consent decree. There's no question about it. It's important to us that the community is at the table, and not just at the table, but at the head of the table, as to what is going to be in this consent decree. Our organization, a little volunteer organization, all volunteers, has held over 24 community events asking people what they want to see in a consent decree. We had 30 canvassers all summer last summer going door to door asking people, telling people about this process and asking, what would you like to see in terms of changes? And we're compiling that into what we call the People's Consent Decree. We also have people every weekend at the farmers market. We have people everywhere doing this kind of work because we don't see other people doing it. And it's important that the community finally have a voice. It has lacked that voice for so very long. And so we're doing this work. So we're not just here to talk and complain. We are people who do the work on the ground, and we do it without pay. But I'm grateful for this opportunity to talk to you about this because, as I said, that report begs for solutions. And what can you as legislators do? You know, we're talking about Minneapolis, and so many people in the room are going to say, well, I don't represent Minneapolis. You know, that's just one police department in our whole state with many police departments. But the material reality is this. There are statutes on the books now that prevent us from making the kinds of changes that need to be made in Minneapolis. There are statutes that haven't been passed that could allow us to make the changes we need to make in Minneapolis. We have brought a package of bills to this body multiple times to ask for the changes we needed. And I've seen those bills not get hearings in the committees. I've seen those bills get sitting on the House floor. I've got one sitting right now that has never been brought up for a vote that directly addresses what happened to Mr. Locke in the no-knock warrant situation that shouldn't have ever happened. And it's frustrating. As somebody who's been, again, doing this work a long, long time, what I have seen in the 2 years nearly since Mr. Floyd was killed is a lack of effort by the legislature, a lack of effort by the city, you know, and to do really, truly meaningful legislative work that could change things and enable us to make the changes we make in Minneapolis. And again, like I tell you, we're not just sitting around complaining. I'm on the mayor's work group to try to make recommendations to get the mayor doing some things now before consent decree comes. I'm working it. I'm doing these things as a volunteer. I'm on the Post Board Rules Advisory Committee pushing for those rules that will hold officers accountable even if they haven't been convicted of a felony. We need those kinds of things in place, but we need you to help us as well. And so that's what I'm here to do, to talk about. So some of the kinds of bills, and not all of them because we don't have enough time, but for example, we have asked you to end Minnesota Statute 626.89, Subdivision 17. That particular piece of legislation prevents communities from having oversight of our police departments, and it needs to go. And we have asked for this now for multiple years. We have asked for law enforcement officers to be required to carry professional liability insurance as a condition of employment. Our organization developed this concept. We worked with insurance professionals, we worked with actuaries, we worked with law enforcement, we worked with labor experts. We have the expertise to make this thing happen. And instead of passing it, what we got was a study that never even happened. We have asked for the creation of an independent investigatory or an independent prosecutory office with investigative powers so that police critical incidents can be investigated by a truly neutral body and acted on accordingly. That never came to light. We couldn't even get a hearing on that one. We have worked to ensure that the efforts by the Post Board to address their deficiencies as a board, because, you know, remember that even to this day, they cannot take action on an officer's license until that officer has been convicted of a felony or some gross misdemeanors. And people may not be aware of this in this room, but Mr. Chauvin, he had an active Minneapolis law enforcement, I mean, a Minnesota law enforcement license. Well, it was inactive once he was fired, but he had a license on the books until the day he was convicted of murdering George Floyd. The other three officers had active licenses until the day they were convicted in the federal court. There were no actions that could be taken on those licenses because of the way that the Post Board rules are written. We are working to change that, to give the Post Board the same amount of power as all of the other licensing bodies in the state. And again, these are things you can push for. These are things we want to encourage you to do. And it's absolutely vitally necessary because the problem is not just a Minneapolis problem. We are not just the largest department in the state, of the most populous city in the state, but we are part of a seven county metro area. But also, these issues exist to some degree or another in many law enforcement departments in the state. I'm not saying all. There are departments doing exemplary work, and there are little kernels of problems here and there. But the laws that are on the books prevent us from taking action on this largest department in the state. And so we're here to ask you, yet again, to please take action to enable us to do the work we need to do as community members in our own community. And I want to implore you to do that. And I thank you for the time.
Thank you, Ms. Wells. Thank you, all three. Hopefully you can stay around for a bit. We'll get to questions and comments shortly. Right now, I believe we have Julia Decker of the American Civil Liberties Union.
Yes, Mr. Chair. I'm on
evening.
Zoom.
Good to see you.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, and members, I'm Julia Decker. I'm the Policy Director for the ACLU of Minnesota. The Department of Human Rights report on the Minneapolis Police Department, as we've heard, details an extensive list of systemic department practices and behaviors that, while deeply troubling, should not really have come as a surprise to this committee. 2 years ago, after the murder of George Floyd, the ACLU of Minnesota submitted testimony to this body urging you to go much further in your state-level policy proposals aimed at preventing harms inflicted by police and promoting accountability where harms occur. In response to the Department of Human Rights report, we've now been asked to testify today regarding state-level policy. and we're here urging you to do many of the same things as in 2020. And since then, Dante Wright and Amir Locke have died at the hands of the state. So as we did in June 2020, we again urge you to narrow state statutes authorizing the use of force and create more stringent requirements for use of force and use of deadly force. We urge creation of a wholly independent prosecutor office for prosecutions of law enforcement. We urge the return of authority to local governments to empower civilian oversight boards. We also urge a full ban on the use of no-knock warrants. We urge forward-looking guardrails around secret warrantless surveillance of Minnesotans, not only via social media, but other technology as well. And we urge the creation of a state court pathway to civil liability for state actors who violate Minnesotans' constitutional rights. This report makes it clear that Black Minneapolis residents are disproportionately affected and harmed by the state in its law enforcement capacity. But all of us need to understand that the power of the state to intrude and impose on people's lives, even to the point of authorizing the taking of one's life, is a power that has implications for the civil liberties of all of us. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Very well. Thank you, Ms. Decker. And we also have Mr. Eric Rice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, everyone, for attending this evening. To introduce myself, my name is Eric Rice. I'm the attorney for Jaleel Stallings, and I've been a defense attorney for more than a decade. I want to share my experience in my practice, so hopefully that it can help. So the Jaleel Stallings matter, just to summarize, he was a protester, and that's when police were hunting for people that evening in an unmarked van and shot at him. He fired back in self-defense, and he was ultimately acquitted. We recently resolved a civil lawsuit, and the 2 years of that experience have shown me just how deep the issues in our system go, and it's made abundantly clear by the DHR report, which shows that the experience of the Jaleel Stallings matter isn't an isolated incident. It's kind of how things go in the system. One thing I want to talk about is who pays the cost. A lot of discussion about these are about the police, but it's also important to focus on the people involved. Working with Jaleel Stallings over the last 2 years, I had personal involvement in seeing how he bore the effects of the system, and it was extremely harsh, and he suffered. Not to mention watching some of the videos and seeing the community members suffering. And I've also reached out to law enforcement and talked with them, and they're also suffering due to the reputational harm and the collateral effects. So it's important to get this right. A couple things I want to highlight is I work in the criminal justice system. I'm a system guy, and my priorities are fairness and justice. And in the criminal justice system, there's a few principles that guide things to make sure things work effectively. One is you empower the people who want to do good. And one thing that has been frustrating in my experience is I have talked to a number of people who want to do good in the system, who see the bad and don't know how to do it or are pushed out. And even tonight, that's what I hear. I see a room full of people who want to do good, and it's a struggle. And it shouldn't be a struggle. They should be empowered to do good. Another tenet is holding bad actors accountable. In the criminal justice system, that is the primary aim, that when people do things, commit misconduct, they are disciplined, they are held accountable, they are discouraged from doing that. Yet in the policing system, as the DHR report highlights, this doesn't occur. It's ironic that these basic law enforcement principles are not applied to the police themselves. And so I want to talk about a couple issues that I found during my practice that would be relevant to the state legislature. One is I believe that greater transparency is necessary. So in the Jaleel Stallings matter, a lot of movement in this case has come from public awareness of what has been going on. But that's been resisted because a lot of the matters were private. And in fact, one of the statutes nearly made the trial exhibits private. Because of a way that the body-worn camera statute is worded, the trial exhibits were considered private data, even though they were played publicly in trial. And we had to fight and motion the court to get them released to the public. In addition, the disciplinary proceedings, they're often used as a shield to prevent accountability rather than a system to impose accountability. In the Jaleel Stallings matter, it appeared that no disciplinary action was taken until there was public reporting on the matter. And only then was a disciplinary action started, and that's when the city relied on the disciplinary action to say nothing further about the matter and provide no additional information. So we would ask the state legislature to make more transparency available. Public awareness has generally been a good thing. The public can be trusted to push for fairness and fairness and justice, and transparency will allow that. In that aim, we'd also ask that civilian review boards be given power to impose discipline or recommend discipline. We'd ask that the Post Board and BCA be empowered to investigate and discipline officer misconduct. Another interesting quirk we ran into is the DHR report noted how few disciplinary matters in Minneapolis went anywhere. And if you try to go outside of Minneapolis, there's no avenue. The Post Board currently doesn't have a strong supervisory role. The BCA, as far as I know, is only empowered to take referrals or act in certain limited matters. So there's no way to bypass an agency if they're not handling a matter themselves. Another issue is in terms of criminal complaints. If you make a criminal complaint against an officer, I found that you have to go through that originating agency to make that complaint. Again, it needs to be referred to the BCA, but I called around to various law enforcement agencies, and although they expressed concern, they couldn't actually take it. It had to go through the agency through, at which the officers worked, and some sort of independent pathway should be established when raising officer complaints. Another interesting issue that I ran into is a conflict of interest that's inherent between the city, the officers, and outside parties. So currently under state law, the city generally indemnifies officers when they commit misconduct and are liable in civil lawsuits. Now, what this does is put the city in an untenable position because the city has the incentive to both discipline the officer to maintain accountability, but also to not discipline or recognize any wrongdoing because doing so could subject them to liability. And so it's not surprising that this lack of accountability exists when the actors who are supposed to and entrusted to have accountability are given this in conflict of interest that prevents them from acting on it. This is important because the police do deserve the public of they do deserve the trust of the public, but the public has to have the trust earned. And in the Jaleel Stallings matter, what I saw was Jaleel was held to a higher standard than the officers were in that case. More was asked of Jaleel in that situation when responding to a deadly force situation that he did not create than the officers were to a force situation that they caused. And to date, Jaleel was criminally prosecuted. He was scorned. He was had his name dragged through the press. And to date, I know of no accountability that has happened to the officers. And I'm here tonight to ask you to empower the people who want to do good. Let these efforts happen, work toward them, and I'm hopeful that once these issues are identified and brought to light as they are, that we can work together to find solutions. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Mr. Rice. Next we have Post Board testimony on the investigation, and we're going to hear from Justin Terrell, who is the committee chair of the Post Board Rules Committee. Welcome, Mr. Terrell.
Thank you, Chair Mariani, Chair Becker-Finn, staff, members. It's been a long day, so I will keep my remarks short, and hopefully you guys can get out of here. My name is Justin Terrell. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Justice Research Center. I want to just start by prefacing my remarks to say that we do have a contract with the Department of Human Rights, and so I won't be saying a ton about the report tonight. I'm actually here tonight in my official capacity as the chair of the Rules Committee at the Minnesota Post Board, and I'm excited to share with you about the work that we've been doing. I'm excited to talk about some of the work that Michelle Gross, who testified earlier, referenced, and thank her for all of her hard work at the overall Rules Committee meeting. To be able to make sure that we completely overhaul licensure for officers in the state of Minnesota. But I'll come back to that in just a moment. So I was appointed to the board by Governor Walz in February 2021, and it's to replace Clarence Castile, who stepped down. Clarence is the uncle of Philando Castile. And since we have a short time, I won't itemize the changes that we're moving through the rules overhaul process, but I will just point you to a couple things that that our organization, the MNJRC, does have coming out. We'll be releasing a report on the post board next week, and we have a policy memo on what is referred to as the conviction standard for officers in the state that I'm happy to share with members around why it is a good idea to remove that standard. But as the chair of the Rules Committee, I oversee the rules making process and have had the privilege of reviewing and advancing the proposals from the Rules Overhaul Committee, where members of law enforcement and advocates debate statute and rule and send our committee their recommendations to review and to be forwarded to the board. I'm pleased to report this body of work that we have taken on is a massive undertaking, but during a tremendous time of tension and folks have been able to collaborate on this project, and some people that you thought would never work together have decided to work together to ensure that we have some standards and minimum standards of conduct that makes some sense. What's important to say in this hearing is that all of you should be proud of this work. if you were to review the current standards of conduct in the rules of the post board, you'll be fairly disappointed. There's just not much there. And what we've proposed and passed through multiple votes, including a 9-3 vote at the full post board meeting, our most recent one, will expand that exponentially. And for the first time in our state, once this works itself through the process, you know, the governor's got to publish this document, and then we also have to, there's an administrative rules judge that will review them and make their recommendations. Hopefully there'll be a public hearing for community members to come out and share their support for these changes. But once that happens, this is one thing that we will be able to point to as a state that is an appropriate and effective response to the murder of George Floyd and the uprising that followed. So let me just, and you guys heard a lot about the problem tonight, so I'm not gonna spend a ton of time, but I think I can kind of sum things up what the problem is with one quick illustration. So recent data I found is that violent crime is actually taking a pause, that things have dropped for a moment in the month of April. We shouldn't hold that as like a trend, it's just something that happened in the month of April. But when specifically talking about juvenile auto theft or juvenile carjackers, if you will. So one of the issues with carjackers, and you hear this reported in the news all the time, is that these kids get arrested for joyriding or whatever, or there's a tragic death or something. But you find that a lot of these kids are being released back into community for various reasons without an intervention. And by the time there is an intervention put in place, the list of victims has expanded exponentially. This is the same situation that we are in when it comes to law enforcement, that an intervention never happens and officers are allowed to continue to commit misconduct with no accountability, no intervention. And by the time we do address it, it's got to rise to the level of a criminal conviction. A criminal conviction is the standard that we hold officers to right now. And by the time you get to a criminal conviction, the list of victims is long. And that is the one thing I will just point you back to the report on, is that it is time that we stop gaslighting communities of color and that we actually believe people when they say that there's racialized policing happening and that we start to work together which is what's happening at the post board when you have activists like Michelle Groh sitting across the table from law enforcement agreeing on things. Overwhelmingly, I think they weren't able to reach consensus on 5 issues out of dozens. And so I think it's important that we remember the seriousness, the setup that we're putting officers in, a lack of accountability, which creates more harm. And now we're in a position where we can actually change the standards of conduct so that officers have some standards that make some sense. So what does this mean? It means that for the first time in our state, once this process is completed, that the post-war will position to hold officers accountable to the standards their profession relies on to serve our communities. That if we continue to invest in the post-war, which you have plenty of policies in front of you this session that do that, officer misconduct can be addressed before it festers and grows into a crime, which we all should be trying to prevent. that sparks an uprising. Departments will still have their policies and procedures. This is really not about taking any authority away from local departments. The union will still have the power to advocate to ensure that officers have quality jobs, but the state sets the minimum standards going forward. That is, we are setting a floor and not the ceiling, a floor that we all can trust, rely on, and hope and stand firmly as a foundation. So I'm gonna close my comments. I have so much more to say, but you guys have had a long day. And I would just say that if law enforcement can work together with activists, that if the business community can support some of the changes that are advancing, if law enforcement members can actually work with the Department of Human Rights, because let's be clear about one thing, is that while community had input on what Commissioner Lucero put together, the reality is that law enforcement, and the only way you're able to tell the story that was told through that report is if law enforcement tells part of it. And that needs to be recognized, that the thin blue line is a little bit thinner after this report. And the citywide still has a ton of work to do, and the department has a ton of work to do. I'm not trying to hand out cookies to anyone, but I just want to recognize that I think there's more people who recognize the problem with racialized policing than have been recently given credit for. And we should find those folks. We should work together to make sure that we actually develop a system of law enforcement in the state that can be a model to the rest of the country and to the rest of the world. You know, there's more I could say. I think there might be some questions, so I can conclude my comments there. But I would just, you know, as always, just remind this body, because of the important work that you do, that justice is an often misunderstood term, that you need to understand that justice needs to be fair, needs to be equitable, needs to have the ability to hold people accountable, and the outcome of justice should always be restorative. And if you consider what we've been through over the last 2 years, measures like the work that folks like Michelle Gross and others are leading at the Pulse Board that will overhaul the standards of conduct for officers in the state, that is actually a restorative outcome. It is an outcome that says that we can restore trust and faith in our systems of government that are responsible to protect public safety in our communities. And with that, I will conclude my comments. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Terrell. Thank you for, frankly, what I take as a message of hope and one that speaks to the wisdom of creating a meaningful table where people from different perspectives and experiences can come together push forward with new ways for us to do this work much better. Your work at the Pulse Board involves such a table where we've got community members, law enforcement, a number of others, and it's helpful to me to hear the fruit of that work going forward. Members, I believe we have one other person from the general public that wishes to testify. So let me call on that person to come forward. And then I believe that puts us at the spot where we can engage in some questions and answer. Good evening. Welcome to the committee. Please begin by stating your name for the record.
Hello, my name is Angela Rose Myers. I am a community member. I've lived in Minneapolis and Ramsey County and in St. Paul, as well as been I'm the previous president of the Minneapolis NAACP, current political action chair for the Minneapolis NAACP, as well as the Minnesota Dakota's NAACP political action chair for the state conference, and a human rights student getting her master's degree at the University of Minnesota.
Welcome.
Thank you. So I want to start my comments with two quotes, one from an elder in the community, a black woman in the community, and another by Prime Minister William Gladstone, who was the Prime Minister of Great Britain in the 1800s. The first being, "The axe can forget, but the tree must remember." And the second being the proper function of a government is to make it easy for people to do good and difficult for them to do evil. Right now in Minnesota and in Minneapolis, as the MDHR report shows, the accountability systems in our city and in our state do not make it easy for police officers to do good, for community members to do good, but rather makes it easy for them to do evil. And us as a community, we remember. We are the tree that remembers every axe, every murder, every police misconduct case. And we carry it with us as we go forward and ask the legislature, ask committees like this to please make change. The warrior mindset from training to the lack of accountability shows that this system in Minneapolis really does create an us versus them mindset, where officers who do evil, which I believe racism and racial discrimination is evil in our country and in our state and in our city, they do not face accountability. And it is the proper function of our government to make sure that they do face accountability. And also with that, it is the proper function that those officers who do good, who want to step in, that they are elevated. Also in the report, it showed that officers of color, women officers, they are faced with derogatory terms. They are faced with intense scrutiny, as well as communities of color are faced with derogatory terms. And this is on the body camera footage of officers. So those who want to raise the issue of police misconduct, Black organizations, Black historical organizations like the NAACP, we have been doing good, doing all of the right things, getting people out to vote, making sure that we are at the table with the police chiefs in Minneapolis, and yet we are surveilled and harassed afterward, after our meetings. We go home, and unknowing to us, covert MPD, social media sites are sending us messages, criticizing us, and surveilling us on social media. So while we as organizations are trying to do good, government resources are put towards surveilling us. And I would also note, as in the report, none of that same surveillance is going to white nationalist, white supremacist organizations. So also for those who try to do good, who try to raise issues of police misconduct, this MDHR report talks about specifically the Minnesota Human Rights Act and what the MPD would need to do to make sure that they would be compliant in the Human Rights Act when it comes to recommendations, and that consent decree would elevate the practices and patterns of MPD to meet the Human Rights Act. But from conversations with community members, I've seen that those who have reported police misconduct, white, African-American, Somali, also, you know, Asian and Latinx, they face scrutiny. I have had, even just in my investigations with the University of Minnesota, doing police surveillance work, sent a report to the UN, Office of the High Commissioner of Human Rights Defenders, about the issue of folks who file police misconduct cases and seeing officers that are named in their case later on at their protest or, you know, outside their homes. This is a serious allegation, I understand. This is just something that is coming from the community. And when it comes to investigating these claims, there is no independent mechanism for them to be investigated in. So again, I bring this to you knowing that these have not been verified or investigated in the full capacity that a state resource could give it. But this is our opportunity to know while community members are bringing this to me as a student, to me as part of the NAACP, this is an opportunity to put state resources into a separate independent investigatory body. So, you know, that also with the idea that we need to create more paths for community voices and protections for those who file police misconduct cases alongside this independent investigatory body. MPD is not an isolated department. It works within a network of law enforcement in the state of Minnesota. And so it's crucial that we don't see just this report as just MPD, but also as a larger issue that is facing our state. And so I really hope that the Post Board and MDHR are empowered and strengthened to audit and oversee Minnesota Police Department's practices and actions, as well as civilian review boards that really need more power to give more than recommendations in this state. I really hope that we address white supremacy in policing, and that we can address the inaccurate information that is given out from state agencies and state government bodies through an independent investigatory body that can investigate police misconduct cases. I hope that you work to end qualified immunity and give policy, again, this is late, so I understand. But again, a licensure. So again, I want to just reinforce that what the elder said to me, and she's out of Louisiana, this black elder. She said, again, the acts can forget, but the tree must remember. And I hope that you as a legislative body and you as folks in this committee can remember the recommendations that community members have brought forward and continue to bring forward today. And that I hope that you remember that the proper function of a government is to make it easy for people to do good and difficult for them to do evil. And I hope that when you're changing this policy in this state, you are changing it with the mindset that we want more folk to do good in this state, and we want more police officers to do good in this state. We want it to make difficult for them to have police misconduct. We want to make it difficult for them to racially discriminate against folk. We want to make it difficult for them to kill people. And that is everything that I have to say. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Meyer. Appreciate your sticking with us here late in the evening. I also appreciate the leadership work that you've been about in our communities for a number of years now. Members, we'll open this up for questions and discussion. We'll begin with Public Safety Vice Chair Cedric Frazier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have some comments, but ultimately I have a question or two for Mr. Terrell from the Post Board. Now, we heard the presentation from the commissioner, and now we have Minneapolis police were found to have a pattern and practice of misconduct that includes dangerous, racially discriminatory, illegal, and unconstitutional conduct. The findings detail in a thorough and undeniable fashion how that misconduct makes it difficult to convict criminals. My belief is that this report also explains how misconduct directly contributes to the public safety crisis narrative that we've heard so much about this year. As a state lawmaker, I lay any misconduct of a licensed profession at the feet of state regulatory boards. Now, everybody knows, for most folks, I am an attorney and I work with teachers. Thousands of members of the teachers union. I represent several each year. So I'm often engaged with regulatory boards. Those boards, despite sometimes our best advocacy, they take action. And they don't hesitate to take action. Because what they understand is that it is vital to take action against those that are acting in a misconduct way that could bring harm to the profession. They understand that taking that action makes the profession better. maintains the reputation of that profession. What I'm hearing here today is that over the past decade, the Post Board has failed to prevent conduct that is clearly affecting Minneapolis peace officer performance. Some have argued in the past that it's because they do not have the authority to take action on misconduct. The way I read the law, I don't believe that's true. Minnesota Statute 626-843 states, the board shall, and I emphasize, shall adopt rules with respect to minimum standards of conduct which would affect the individual's performance of duties as a peace officer. And the board shall review the minimum standards of conduct described in this clause for possible modification every 3 years after that time. This law has been on the books since 1977. We were leading as a state by developing the Post Board at that time. We fell behind with the way our regulatory bodies are working now. After I conducted extensive research, it is my understanding that the Post Board has not made any significant changes to its standard of conduct rules without legislative direction in the past half century. And it has chosen instead to handcuff its own ability to act by requiring a criminal conviction for civil licensure action, which you've heard people testify today. I must say, if the legislator wanted there to be a criminal standard for the board to act, it would have established a criminal standard. It would have been explicit. It would have been a statute. It is not. Which leads me to this question from Mr. Terrell. Currently, absent a criminal conviction, is the following misconduct detailed in this report, which includes violation of First Amendment freedom to assemble by spying on civic organizations without an investigatory purpose, or use of excessive force, like choking out a 14-year-old in his bedroom because he doesn't comply right away, or obstruction of justice by intentionally obstructing body camera, or providing false information in police reports and court documents. Mr. Terrell, is any of this misconduct detailed in this report a violation of the Post Board standard of conduct as currently enforced?
Mr. Chair,
as currently, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Frazier, Vice Chair Frazier, as currently enforced, no. The way that things are currently enforced right now is that Derek, I think it was mentioned earlier that Derek Chauvin kept his license up until the day he was convicted of murder. There's no action to be taken on. An officer can violate the First Amendment, can use excessive force, can lie, can do all these things that I think the average citizen would assume are part of their standards of conduct. But the reality is that there will be no intervention from the state unless that behavior is self-reported or which doesn't really happen. All of the hearings that I've been a part of, without discussing or disclosing any of that data, the majority have been criminal convictions. The overwhelming majority have been criminal convictions. And so, unfortunately, no. Like, there's no level or system of accountability to respond to officer misconduct in an appropriate way. They have to commit a crime, which means they have to create a victim before they can be held accountable. And then I'll just say, you brought up the history of the Post Board, and you're right. We were one of the first in the nation to, we were the first in the nation to establish a regulatory body for law enforcement. And generally, I think people thought it was a great idea when it started. But over time, what you see is law enforcement likes to be able to navigate in wide lanes. I mean, their job is difficult when you consider what they're responding to in community. And so they want the leeway and flexibility. And the reality is that is the narrative that has persisted, which means that accountability has been set to the background. And I would argue that when you introduce, race and gender and other the intersection of other identities with policing, that they wanted maximum flexibility in those situations. And I think that the EHR report kind of points to that. And so with maximum flexibility and no accountability, I think folks are in trouble. And now it's time for us to right size that effort that was started, 40 plus years ago, to ensure that we actually have some sort of accountability measures.
Vice Chair, for
you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Terrell. You mentioned in your testimony that the Post Board has currently taken some actions on some new rules. Is that correct?
Mr. Terrell.
That's correct. Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Frazier, forgive me, it's late. that's correct. So we passed a draft of the overhaul of the rules for the minimum selection standards that is to become an officer, the minimum standards of conduct that is how you should behave as an officer, and a range of model policies that provide guidance to local departments on how to respond to things that a smaller department may not be thinking about every day. We passed the draft of those rules by a vote of 9-3 just a few weeks ago at the full board meeting. And then my committee actually took up a revised draft from the revisor, just, some technical edits at our meeting, I believe on May 5th, if you want to visit our website and watch and read the, look at the notes or get an example of what's actually going into this rules overhaul project.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Mr. Terrell. So with these draft rules, and I know they have to go through the process, but if these rules do in fact become the new rules that will be enforced, will the actions that have been found in the MDHR findings, will those type of actions now be allowed? Will those type of actions now be able to be reviewed by the Post Board, and actions will be able to be taken on those?
Mr. Terrell.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Frazier, the answer is yes. The rules overhaul, it absolutely explicitly, what it does is it brings the rules into alignment with statute. And so that we don't have this sort of bifurcated set of standards, but more so what it does is it says that, yeah, absolutely not, like excessive, there's a statute on excessive force, but there wasn't a rule on excessive force, and it just remedies that. Providing false testimony to another officer or to the board or a department or a court, These things are in the new set of rules. We have First Amendment protection model policy that one of the testifiers, Angela Myers, worked on, the work group that developed that. So yes, the changes that we are making, they are meaningful. And frankly, without being dramatic, but I want to be sincere, is that they're transformative. They are an opportunity to transform the professional law enforcement, to bring it into alignment, not just with statute, but with the values commonly held with Minnesotans across the state, especially folks in our community who feel specifically targeted, especially after the events of George Floyd and after the release of this report, but especially after the events that happened this weekend in New York. We know we have an issue with white supremacy. That is also going into the standards of conduct. And we seek to just ensure that in the case of white supremacy anyway, that law enforcement and communities of color actually understand that we have a shared enemy in that respect, because the body count for white supremacists and as far as how many officers are killing is going up. And so we need to make sure that we start to see common threats as common threats and that we be, and that folks work together to respond to those. But all of that is going into the new rules overhaul. And it is clearly a step in the right direction.
Thank you, Mr. Terrell. I'll close out, but I want to say, I know you mentioned that the vote was 9-3 to move those rules forward. And I know, like most licensure boards and professional boards in our state, the majority of the members on those boards are actually, in fact, practicing members. So that board has a majority of licensed law enforcement members on it. So I want to say is, I want to thank the law enforcement individuals on that board who serve on the Post Board, who have taken this courageous step. But specifically, I want to thank Chair McCarthy, who I know has been the subject of attacks, for leading the board to this action. Thank you to the administration, who I often have my differences with,
about police and policy, for leading by appointing these members and signing the Minnesota Police Accountability Act. Thank you to my posse member colleagues and legislative allies for writing the Minnesota Police Accountability Act that, among other things, has transformed the Post Board and led to these rules changes. Lastly, and most importantly, thank you to the community members whose experience, protests, and testimony inspired the Minnesota Police Accountability Act and who serve on the Post Board and help write the rule changes. To anyone who doubts the need for these changes, if these findings don't show you that Minneapolis cannot fix itself by itself, I don't know what will. It should go without saying that we need quality, well-funded law enforcement, and that most officers do a good job. Despite making that clear every time I speak on this issue, my efforts to put in place common sense licensing regulations have been described as defunding the police, hating the police, getting in the way of good policing, and making us less safe. But what I've heard here is that misconduct makes us less safe. But what I've heard, unaccountability undermines quality policing and allows criminals to get away. I have a provision in our conference committee bill right now that will remove the conviction standard and allow POST to function like any other licensing board. I will say there is another bill that would handcuff the POST board even more by requiring legislative approval for any licensure change. And also there's a bill that would provide tens of millions in bonuses to cops regardless if they engage in some of the disgusting and racist behaviors in this report. In light of these findings, I hope they reconsider the wisdom of some of these approaches, because as we've heard today, unaccountable law enforcement makes us all less safe. And that is not our job. Our job is to make us all safe. I yield back, Chair.
Thank you, Representative Frazier. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. And I simply wanted to note how, I guess, I think it was Mr. Hussein who made a comment in the course of his presentation about how, I don't think he phrased it quite this way, but how deeply American this report is. I've been thinking a lot with the international situation. We invest the police with a lot of power. That's appropriate. And in my work as a prosecutor, I work closely with police. And it is absolutely important that the different institutions of our society receive great scrutiny. And what we've had is we've had state government examining and producing a report about what they have found. There is so much to be appalled by in this report, but I'll just note that, again, as a prosecutor, one thing that jumped out at me, I think it's on page 38, there's several other references as well, but that one jumped out in particular, the fact that that the conduct of some officers was such that prosecutors were not able to either put them on the stand or play body camera video because of conduct. I have not had the experience in my work over in Ramsey County with officers testifying from Minneapolis, and I've certainly worked with many very, very, very good officers from that department. But I want to note, on top of the many, many other reasons for concern, we want to make sure that when we have somebody committing a crime and having a charge brought against them, that we can actually have that charge stick. And on top of everything else that we read in here, we have the concerns with having, with even following through on that in holding accountable people who've committed crimes. And so I really just am grateful to the chairs for putting this together, the Department of Human Rights for the work, which again, I think in this examination upholds the best of our ideals. We really are now called to act now that we have this information and to make sure that we can have, the people of Minneapolis can have confidence in their department and the rest of us can all have confidence in that work as well. Thank you so much to the chairs. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Representative Pinto. Representative Johnson.
Chair Mariani, members, I'll keep this as brief as possible. It's getting late. Listening through this, I'm disappointed that one of the key things in this report that I read was never mentioned. It's the lack of leadership at the city council, the mayor's office, and the administration of the police department. Now, you look at other departments across the state, and I'm disappointed that they're using a broad brush that all law enforcement is like this. It's not. You have Minneapolis on one side of the river that has all sorts of problems. And the report shows it goes to the leadership right to the top, the city council and the mayor and the administration going back decades. You come to this side of the river, guess what? We don't hear problems. The mayor and the city council have been doing their jobs. The police chief and his administration have been doing their jobs. What's going on in Minneapolis? Lack of leadership. We've talked about it many times. We talked about accountability of the officers. Absolutely, I want those that do things improperly held accountable. Notice in the pages in the report where at one time it was 500 days between discipline from the time of the incident, over 500 days. Minneapolis has a civilian review board that never met to deal with the issues. When there's a problem, it needs to be dealt with immediately, as soon as possible, before minor issues become large issues. Again, the city of Minneapolis failed their department and their citizens. It's not the rest of the state, it's the city of Minneapolis where the problem is. With the mayor, the city council, going back decades. Now other departments, again, we don't really hear of many issues, except in one city, which I brought up many times already, and I get chastised by some members of this committee because I bring it up. That's where the problem is. You have to take a look at it where it's at. We have over 10,000 licensed officers in this state, and we're way short right now. Because of the attacks on all law enforcement and not where the problem is. The city council and the mayor and the police administration of the Minneapolis Police Department. A couple of years ago, I met in one of the precincts with administration of the police department. I had a pastor that's been wanting to work and help, get involved. He's been working the streets, talking to the youth, working with the youth to keep them out of trouble. He was told, we'll notify you right away the next meeting. That was 3 years ago. He's still waiting for that email and that phone call. And he's still working with those youth and helping all he can. And his church was right in the riot area. Again, Minneapolis administration, city council, and the mayor failed the citizens of Minnesota. And because of that, they're causing issues all across this state. I'm also reading through the report dealing with the decree. It needs to be an independent to go in there. But you read the report, we're hearing that the Department of Human Rights and the failed leadership of the city council and the mayor is going to pick the people to do that. It needs to be independent. That's what I wanted to talk to the commissioner about and ask the question, but they had to leave. I don't want to get into the facts of the investigation because that's improper. But doing that with that decree, if it's not independently appointed, it's doomed to failure. I'm going to let it stop here because this is investigation is continuing. It's not done. I have concerns that some of the things spoken today might cause some issues, and I don't want to be part of that. But we need to look at where the problem started. The failed leadership of the mayor, the city council, and the Minneapolis Police Department administration for decades.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. We are here to listen to one another and share our thoughts with one another, and I think that's a good spirit for us to continue in. Representative Long.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have two questions because I know we're getting late. I just first wanted to thank Commissioner Lucero and the Department of Human Rights for their excellent work. I know a number of my Minneapolis colleagues are in attendance tonight, and we put out a joint statement after the report came out, noting that these findings unfortunately did not surprise us and show what many of us have known for too long, which is that there is a deep trust gap in our city between our police department and our community. I also want to thank the public testimony tonight, which showed this very clearly. We have certainly a lot of work to do, and I am hopeful that this report and hopefully the consent decree that will follow will make meaningful steps. I also believe that the Department of Human Rights was absolutely accurate in its conclusion that this will not be solved without deep organizational cultural change. One of those pillars, I think, of cultural change is accountability, as Commissioner Lucero said well. I had a question for Mr. Rice. You said that you know of no accountability for the officers who were involved in the Jaleel Stallings shooting. And I wanted to know if you know if any disciplinary actions have been pursued, and if you know if the officers remain on the force.
Mr. Rice, are you still with us?
I am, thank you, and thank you for your question. So there's two parts of that answer. One is, because disciplinary information is private data, I, as the attorney for the subject of the complaint, have not been able to get much information about it. So what I've had to do is do public records access about the case, and what I've found is there are emails discussing disciplinary action, and those emails discuss a disciplinary action that was opened on September 1st, 2021, which is the day that the Stallings case was publicly reported. That was a year and a half after it occurred. That was about a month or more than a month after Mr. Stallings was acquitted. And so as best I can tell, disciplinary action likely would not have occurred if there weren't public reporting. And knowing more about it is difficult because all of the information is private. But to date, I don't know of any sustained disciplinary actions or anything that is concluded. Given the DHR report, my expectation is that the investigation that started in September will likely take a year and a half or more to complete.
Representative Long.
Thank you, Mr. Rice. It's disappointing to hear that the disciplinary proceedings did not begin until it was public scrutiny. I think that certainly shows there's a real broken system for accountability. I was also just hoping to put this in a bit of a broader context, this hearing. Representative Johnson commented that it's not the rest of the state, it's the city of Minneapolis. Commissioner Lucero mentioned one of their findings was that MPD was more likely to stop people of color and more likely to treat them differently when they're pulled over. And that reminded me of the tragedy of Lando Castile, who was killed by St. Anthony police in Falcon Heights in 2016. He was pulled over because of his white set nose. And at the time of his death, he'd been pulled over 49 times before. When the Star Tribune went and looked at St. Anthony's records, they found that 41% of the people the St. Anthony Police Department arrested were black, which was seven times their population of 6% black residents. So the Star Tribune then asked, well, was it just St. Anthony? And they concluded, no, nearly every Twin Cities metro area police department exhibited a racial disparity in its arrest rates. Minneapolis was certainly one of the largest, but other notable ones were Crystal with a 40% disparity. Edina had a 44% disparity. Bloomington, a 28% disparity. St. Paul, on the other side of the river, a 29% disparity. Brooklyn Park had a 27% disparity. So then the question was, well, maybe this is only a metro problem. But no, statewide studies have shown that blacks all across Minnesota are three times more likely to be stopped than whites. So I don't think we should pretend that racialized policing is a one-city problem. And I was just curious for Mr. Terrell's perspective, working at the statewide level and from the Post Board, your position thinking about these issues. Is this a Minneapolis-only problem?
Mr. Terrell, you're still with us.
Thank you, Chair Mariani and Representative Long. I appreciate the question, and the simple answer is no. This is not just a Minneapolis problem. This is a problem with the profession of law enforcement. When you don't have standards that clearly point to not allowing you to do race-based policing, race-based policing will occur. And so it's as simple as that. But you know, in my experience, and I appreciate you running those numbers down, because in my experience, the other thing that's important to note is that the experience of Black folks, we've been saying that there's been race-based policing across the state for generations. Rochester, you know, has its own story. Moorhead has its own story. Wilmer has its own story. Like, this is not local to Minneapolis by any means. But the problem is, and Representative Johnson, not to pick on you, sir, but the reality is that until there's a report done by another person of color that has the force of the state behind it, no one ever believes us. And the thing that also never happens is Representative Long is reporting on numbers from journalists, right? And Commissioner Lucero is using data from the city and the department. But what we never, it's funny that there's never a report that speaks to the other side, right? That does the rigor to show that there isn't racial discrimination. As a matter of fact, we spend most of the exercises usually focused on dismissing the claims of my community, even just a few days after a white supremacist guns down Black folks on purpose. And we're still debating, is this just a Minneapolis problem? That makes no sense to me. And it raises suspicion, because I don't understand why anyone in this committee or anyone with an election certificate isn't rushing to the aid of community members who are being targeted by white supremacists, who are being failed by the criminal legal system, and who are living the reality of everything that you read in that report. And so you have a report about a specific place, but the same experience is being carried out across the state, and it is a responsibility of this body and the Senate and the governor's office for you all to work together to not just try to solve this problem, but to start by believing and seeing it first. What do you expect people to do if we are constantly dismissed? I'll close with this quick anecdote, is a quick story. I buried my cousin yesterday. He is the 27th, I believe is the 27th homicide in the city of Minneapolis this year. And so, like, trust me, I know, like, violent crime is real and it hurts, and it's a struggle for families to deal with. This is the third cousin that we've had that I've lost in the last 5 years. And I think that every single time we've engaged with law enforcement, they have failed to, you know, comfort us and get us through a process. There's been some good things. There's been some really hard things. But what I struggle with is that. Sorry, my apologies. But what I struggle with is that we continue to talk about harsher criminal penalties as a deterrence to criminal behavior, but we can't talk about minimum selection standards as a deterrence for officers. We're talking about violent crime, but we're not talking about clearance rates for violent crime. We're putting money over here to address, you know, recruitment, but we're not talking about what the officers do once they're recruited. This is insane. And it's something that we can show, that has been proven that we can solve if we just set aside things and work together. This is not an unfixable problem. And it for sure is not just the Twin Cities problem. This is a statewide problem that deserves a statewide response. And I'll just say this. I encourage you to remember how you felt the day you saw the George Floyd video, how your constituents reached out to you and said, hey, maybe there's something here, to believe that as well. And let's get to work on fixing this problem that is completely fixable. So that's my response to that. My apologies if I'm a little rambly, but thank you, Mr. Chair.
No apologies.
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Terrell. Representative Hewitt, and then We'll move to close this discussion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to all the testifiers and the participants tonight. And as somebody that's worked in an arm of public safety with EMS, I mean, yes, this report is really unremarkably sad. And I have tons of questions here, from FTO training programs to education to what happens after a police officer, like we were just talking about, finishes skills and then goes on to what I believe would be orientation into a department. And I'm just flabbergasted over what I heard tonight. One of the things that I'm hoping, and I'm not a lawyer, so I'm not going to the 10,000 foot level, which I have to thank my colleagues for doing. But I really, the indemned immunity, I think there's people in the room that can kind of help me with this, and you maybe don't have the answers tonight, but I am really curious about this. And I've been looking at this since I've been on this committee. In EMS, we are insured. We are not covered by the cities in most cases. The cities cover us, but it's really, we have to pull our own insurance. Doctors have to pull their own insurance. But I cannot find a city or a state that requires police officers to do this yet. And if we do have one, or you got to come up if you're going to talk, because I would like it on the record if we do have a state. But that's where I'm having my struggle. And you can talk to me later on, too. It's okay. But I would like to know more about this, because I think we definitely need to see what this looks like. I know that it's just a real hard thing to capture, because if we do this, basically, would we just send it over to the cities and have them cover it? I mean, I don't know. And these are the questions I have about this. And I know what my cities have told me. But it doesn't mean we shouldn't really look into this and see if this will help. And if you do have a place, I'd like to know where it helped. Just a big question on this, because I think this is a very good question to ask. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, thank you, Representative Hewitt. And we have had some discussions in the last couple of years about this. And I think Ms. Gross was offering to provide you some information afterwards as well. Very well. I did overlook Representative Bank.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to thank everyone for being here tonight. I know it's been a long day, and thank you to all the testifiers for being here. It's important to hear from all of you. I think this question can go to any of the testifiers here today. Can you provide some examples of what community members want to see in a consent decree? And please keep your remarks concise, as I know it's been a long day for everyone. Thank you.
Is there anyone in there? I think Ms. Gross would sure, yeah, please.
Sorry, I was on the mic.
Ms. Gross.
Thank you. Chair Mariani and Representative Bang, we have, as I mentioned before, had an entire summer last summer of going door to door with 30 canvassers, talking to people in Minneapolis, as well as holding over 24 events around the city in parks, where so it could be safe, where people could come out, and hundreds upon hundreds of people showed up to tell us what they wanted out of a potential consent decree. And so we have just amassed an enormous amount of data that we're massaging into a demand type of thing. And some of the kinds of things that people really want is much stronger civilian oversight. Right now, the Office of Police Conduct Review that Jaylani mentioned earlier, that office has an absolutely pathetic record. It is controlled 100% by city staff and the police department. There is no true oversight, civilian oversight in that. There really is none. And again, they have an abysmal record. They have a less than 0.5% sustain and discipline rate. And when the national average for oversight bodies is, as Jaylani mentioned, 7 to 8%. And so we are really the low-end outlier. And so that's a lot of what people are saying they want out of you know, they want a better accountability mechanism. And Attorney Rice talked about this as well. There isn't, you know, it's not independent. It's actually owned by the city, and there's an incentive because the city is self-insured for police accountability lawsuits, there's a huge incentive not to discipline officers, because then that discipline can then be used to generate, you know, to up the value of lawsuits, essentially. And so that's another very large issue with the city, is being self-indemnified for police accountability incidents. And so and to the effect that literally we budget about $19 million a year as a city for police accountability, and right now we have used up the next 7 or 8 years' worth in all of these large judgments that they've paid out. I'm a property owner. I mean, a modest home in North Minneapolis, and my property taxes went up 33% this year as a result of all of these lawsuits. So even if you don't care how the cops act and you think you're fine and whatever, you got to at least care about how much money it's costing us. And so that's a big thing that people are talking about. The biggest is accountability. There's a lot of little tinkering around the edges. There's things like people want to be able to read the officer's badge, name and number, which you cannot read right now because of the way those badges are made. There's a ton of other little things. I'd be happy to work with you and provide that information to you and to everybody in this room. But, like I said, we're still massaging that list. But the community has very rich ideas about what they want to see happen. And one of the most important things they want to see happen is an end to this racist policing.
And if I can add, Representative Bank, to what Michelle said, and I want to give tremendous praise for Michelle and her team really this past summer to engage thousands of residents. Many were also afraid to even share this information with us. I'll just add by saying that we're also seeking resources and support, experts, national experts, and also other communities that have gone through other dissent decree. And so we're looking at trying to really build something that will actually work and impact immediately and have long-lasting changes. And I think a court order is something that is unique, and we want to be able to get the most out of it.
That's right. You know, and if I could add, I know that it's very late and I apologize. We're also talking to the community about what they want out of a monitor, because the monitors are the secret sauce that makes a consent decree work. I've worked on and talked with people in parts all over this country whose departments are under a consent decree. And so the monitoring is a very important piece of this as well. And so we can't let that run by the wayside. And so those are areas we're also working on. And thank you again for your time.
Ms. Gross, are you okay? Ms. Gross, as long as I have you there. Representative Johnson earlier spoke about an important role for an independent presence.
Yes.
I don't want to put words in his mouth, but he called for an independent, the role for some independent presence in this work. Your quick thoughts about whether, on that notion of a needed presence that has a sort of third-party perspective. And I think, Representative Johnson, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I think you were partly putting that within the context of, and I think Mr. Rice spoke to this issue as well, that, just simply leaving it to the city, doesn't seem to be an effective, accountability presence.
Yes.
By itself.
Thank you, Chair Mariani and Representative Johnson. What the MDHR is doing is, they're the people that have to actually enforce the law, and the law is the Minnesota Human Rights Act. And so they're responsible for actually, enforcing that law. They have to be the ones to actually negotiate with the city. But one of the things that we've made clear to them in our meetings with them is that it is not going to be just them and the city in the room. They will probably realistically be physically in the room, but we want them to carry with them the demands of the community to be part of this. And they are also working with 21st Century Policing, that agency and that organization, to bring in that national perspective and that national expertise. And I think that, with the 21CP and the demands of the community, kind of all of this coming together in one place, you end up, it's not just, Commissioner Lucero and some, the mayor and maybe a couple city council members haggling it out in the room. It brings a whole body of people to the table. But that's one of the reasons why the work we're doing with our outreach is so key to this whole thing. You know, they have their own outreach plan, but we have a long, long history of being in the community and doing this work, and that gives us the credibility such that we can have a booth at events all over the city and maintain a booth every weekend at the farmers market where we're still collecting, you know, the experiences of people. We turned over over 1,500 experiences of Minneapolis residents to the Department of Justice as part of their investigation, as well as to the Minnesota Department of Human Rights. We also turned over 10,000 documents, because the city has a retention schedule, and those documents go away at a point, and they're looking at 10 years' worth. Our retention schedule is never get rid of anything, and so we have zillions of documents that we turned over, like I said, at least 10,000 to those two agencies to assist with their investigation. And you know, whether you call us independent or not, we are members of the community, and we certainly feel like having the community at that table really counts. And then again, those national professionals, I think, are the people. And listen, you know, all of you in this room, if you have something to say about this, the things that you want to see in the consent decree, if you want to have something to say about the investigation itself, you can feel free to reach out to the Minnesota Department of Human Rights. We have had no problem scheduling meetings with them. We've had no problem scheduling meetings with the DOJ. You could do the same thing we're doing, and I would encourage you to do so.
Very well, thank you. Representative Shaw, I think you're the last one on your list.
Some of the questions I had were answered. I just want to quickly say I want to thank Commissioner Lucero and her team for their work, and to our community members for being here tonight. I hope that we can have a more fruitful conversation when the forward investigation and consent decree are solidified. That said, I want to say, to respond to remarks about this being a Minneapolis leadership problem, we've seen similar problems, not just in our state, but around the country. And some of those Minneapolis leaders are our colleagues right here in the Minnesota legislature. And they have been pushing for accountability and reform. We just heard from Representative Jamie Long and Mr. Terrell that these issues are not limited to just Minneapolis. We as a state have a duty to address these issues, and if we don't, the Minnesota legislature fails to find a solution, we are equally as at fault as the city of Minneapolis. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, thank you, Representative Jung.
Chairman,
I do want to acknowledge we had the presence of other legislators, our other colleagues, in and out of the room. Here this evening, Representative Agbaji, Chair Davney, who I believe also chairs the Minneapolis delegation in the House, Representative Reiner, Representative Jordan. Didn't see you come in, and Representative Agreement as well. So thank you to my colleagues for joining these two committees for this this conversation, this hearing here today. I also do want to acknowledge my former legislative assistant, Jason Chavez, who's here with us today. I miss you, not having you up here by my side. Also, I do want to share that Representative Becker-Finn left a little while ago. I believe today, tomorrow is the anniversary of her dad's passing. I actually served with Senator Finn many years ago in the 90s, a fine gentleman, human being, and a good legislator as well. Members, I really want to I want to thank all the testifiers, not only for your testimony here today, but also for your work and your presence in our beloved Minnesota communities, working to make it better. It's a pleasure to work with all of you. And I want to close by just thanking the committee members. It's been a long day for all of us.
And, 13 hours.
Yes, indeed. Representative Johnson, you and I started together. I was a little late to that, so you beat me by a good 10, 15 minutes. But no, truly, I really want to express my appreciation to all of you for saying that this is important enough for us to come together at the end of a long day to listen, to learn, and to engage with one another. And Hopefully we can continue to carry that spirit forward and continue to take action. So much of what we heard, from many of our testifiers here today. And Representative Chair Moran and also Representative Richardson were with us online. That's the trick about online. You don't know who's there or not. So with that, members, get some rest. We'll be back at this tomorrow. And thank you again. This joint committee hearing stands adjourned.